Well, no, I went back to the journal, and the editor, no, the, what is Bill Tracy? He's in the library. He's also the national chairman of the Salvian Society, George Bernard Shaw, and he's a friend of mine. And he had me go through photographs in the journal to try to help him label some of the figures in that strike. And when he went through them, we realized that there had been a big rifling job, a big stealing job out of the journal pictures. And then I asked if they had microfilm or something that I might see some of the old stories that the journal had, and those too have been destroyed. And I was quite surprised to learn of this, and he doesn't have any idea how it happened. But the librarian at the time of the strike itself was a sympathizer of ours, and later joined the Trotskyist movement. And he came to our house one time, and we thought he was another agent long after the strike was over. And I was very concerned about him. For a long time, I didn't feel happy. But he became more dedicated, and he remained much longer than I did in the movement. So we knew that he had been a very meticulous collector of everything during the strike. Pictures and all kinds of things ever were filed properly. And what happened between that and the time that Bill Chase took over, nobody ever knows. Because I thought I could use the journal files.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? You said before that very often the women would have problems going into the community with their berets. So the community was aware, though, then, and there must have been enough publicity about
yes.
That they were aware when they would see a woman in a red beret what that
meant. Oh, of course, yes. We got quite a few pictures and quite a few stories in the press in the general area. So the Detroit News, the Detroit Times, and of course all of the anti-articles in the journal, and all of the announcements over the radio.
Mm.
And sometimes they would even use such terms as the wild screaming women, and the unruly Amazons, and I can think of all kinds of labels that they used over the radio to turn public sentiment against us. We certainly were anything but a cultured, lovely element of society, you know, that most women were considered.
Well, now, is this all before the Chevrolet takeover or after?
It was before and during, up until the end of the strike.
I mean, it wasn't just that action focused more on the brigade, but even before that, there was community reaction
to. From the time we first made our announcement, yeah, from it was somewhat of a shock. From the time we first made our announcement that we were organizing, even before we got the brigade berets and the armbands,
mm-hmm.
It was a.
What was the relationship like among the women in the brigade themselves?
The relationship between the women in the brigade themselves. Well, they were bound together by stronger ties than when they were in the auxiliary. But you know, it's a very difficult thing to explain, but these people were in the brigade were just hit and missing, you know, always. You would be going out with five women on this project one day, the next day you would come up and you'd be sent out on another with other women. And the brigade itself, I don't think, was called together any more than once, which is a time. The brigade itself, you know. But it was a hit and miss operation, but they just had the feeling, because it was imbued in them from the time they signed up, you know, this woman is really dedicated. You don't have to worry about her, you know, or you don't have to bother to try to educate her. If she signed up in the brigade, she already knows what side she's on. Nobody could move her. And there was a feeling of sureness, of course, when they were together.
But as a result,
but they didn't really get
there. There was no real development of bonds.
No. No. Mm-hmm. That is one of our problems today. Mm-hmm. These women never got to know each other, their children, their homes, or make any kind of permanent bonds. And then, of course, immediately that the strike was over, the men wanted them back, and of course, they felt that was their place to go back and clean up the pile of laundry and the kids and all of the problems that had developed and get them from relatives and so children from relatives. And they really never got to know each other. And the whole 44 days, you know, is not long to form any kind of a friendship. That's right. And the men knew each other from their job conditions, and afterward from the job and the union hall, they knew men from other plants, other areas, and their friendships continued on a stable, longer basis, you know. Women only came together, boom, like that, and that's why when we tried to, and the records were destroyed, we had no way of going after them. That's why it's so hard for us to get them, and that's why it's so hard for one woman to remember another.
Mm-hmm.
Even when I...
There was no way did you give thought to the idea of the squad being more permanent, so that when the squad was sent out here or out there, it was always the same group of women so that those ties could develop?
No possibility of it. You're talking now about a group of women with no responsibilities that would be able to be at the headquarters all day or the same number of hours every day. These women couldn't even come down the same number of hours every day. And so when I'm talking about, there was somewhere around 400 or 500 that had signed up in the brigade. Now that sounds like a tremendous number, doesn't it? But when you stop to think about the obligations that women had, and yet they were assigned at any time they were called to come down there, the tremendous obligations that they had, at no one time did we get a chance to ever have, you know, that many of them. They would come down to the, maybe they'd have to skip a couple of days, or a child would become sick, or something like that. It was...
So maybe there would be just 100 or so that at any one time committed.
That would be the maximum. That would be the maximum. And then they would be spread out, so many would be here, there, and the other places, and we didn't just stand around and talk or gossip at any time. There wasn't really any time when you got to get acquainted with a woman, except on the picket line. You'd be walking together, you know, up and down for hours of time, go over to the strike kitchen or go over to a coffee restaurant to have coffee and then back on the picket line. You'd get to know that woman. Now, if that woman could get down the next time, at the same time the next day, and there were some little bonds, little friendships that grew together, and, of course, if they came down and they were together at the same time, they arranged between themselves, they usually went out again. And there were some that did operate together, but nothing like you would imagine, nothing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's more understandable now to me, because I envisioned being together in a situation like that with the danger and the need for trust, that there would be very intense bond form, but now realizing that
it was,
you had to be with different people all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's more understandable why it felt hard.
Yes.
Too,
yes.
And
like,
it's been hard to keep track of
them. They never had each other's addresses, and of course, some of them didn't. Many of them didn't have telephones,
mm-hmm.
so they could never get in touch with them afterwards.
Was there any?
Do you know? I even myself, I never really got to know these women on the basis that I would like to have gotten to know them. I would get a chance to talk to them maybe a few moments as individuals, but there was always going and address this mass meeting or be assigning this or doing that or getting out myself somewhere, you know. And I never got a chance really to know them.
About the political consequence of the women, but I started to ask, was there any time that you were, out of these 400 women, particularly since you didn't know a lot of the women, with the kind of spying that was going on, for instance, was there any time that you were ever suspicious that there were company spies among the women themselves that were coming in to the auxiliary and then ultimately into the brigade?
No. No. We could tell if a woman had been worked on, she would just drop out quietly. But we never had any trouble that way because, you see, that wasn't the... You couldn't threaten the woman with the loss of her job immediately. They could go to the woman and say, your husband will be fired if you don't drop out. But with a man, they would threaten him, and he was very apt to go out and broadcast it all over if he was a strong union man. And The spies were operating amongst the men. They were the men in the plants that operated those plants. The women didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have any problem like that.
No, not the
women wouldn't continue to, if they had been talked to, they would not continue to come down. They might harp and stay at home and harp with their husbands, but we didn't have any of those problems.
What do you think the political consciousness of the other women in the brigade was like? What was the range of their consciousness?
Well, I think I spoke to you about the small minority of women that three of them belonged to the Lovestonite group that had previously broken off from the Socialist Party. Then we had a group of socialist women in there, and we had a group of women newly affiliated with the Communist Party. And these women in the Communist Party had no leadership, but they would very often follow instructions. And their spokesman was Dorothy Krauss. But outside of that,
400, would you say, did the groups with a political ideology constitute?
Let's see, 10, 20, maybe 1/20, 1/10 would be 40, maybe 20 women could be classified, 1/20.
Mm-hmm. And the rest of the women just saw their role in terms of helping the men in the union.
Yes, yes. And most of them saw their role very, very immediately, not even in connection with the national picture and the necessity for organizing the industrial union. But they saw it mainly in terms of getting a husband that was not so beaten up, you know, getting some kind of relationship as a father and a husband, and in terms of getting food on the table regularly, and of easing their problems and helping to raise the family in a better style, manner of living.
Very few of them saw themselves as part of a much broader struggle, or even as part of a UAW struggle, let alone a broader struggle.
No, very few of them. The great majority of them had very immediate problems at home, and they didn't get a chance to get any of the education except through what other women would tell them. And then when we directed a number of them to go into the men's mass meetings when speakers like Leo Krutsky and Paula Pat Goog and Rose Basoda, the other garment workers and so on, would come in, we directed them so that they could hear these speakers and get some kind of education. And, of course, they, too, would absorb it when they got it, but the main concern with them was their families and children. They'd had such a hell of a life.
So the majority of the women in the brigade then were relatively unsophisticated,
yes.
The wives of really pretty beaten down.
Yes, and they had little education, they had opportunities for very little exposure to anything.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was an organization that the company, the General Motors, had maintained. They deducted money out of the men's paychecks to build a big auditorium, and it was called the Industrial Mutual Association, which they forced workers to belong to by this automatic deduction. And they had big dances down there with main bands that would come in, and occasionally, because it was so cheap to get into this dance and it was to keep the workers pacified, a wife might be able to get down and go to one of these dances with her husband. They had a few clubs, but very few women could participate in the clubs of the IMA. And then they had a Potter's Lake swimming lake and swimming facilities, but very few workers got a chance to go out there either. It was for percentage, and it was for propaganda. We're concerned with the workers. But otherwise, women didn't get a chance to get out of their homes.
See, I think that the end of the reveals why they don't recall it very well. Their lives
have
been so isolated. They were so isolated. They didn't have a political consciousness. There was a moment in their life, and they went back to the isolated existence again.
And you know, now that I can recall some of these things a little more vividly, when some of the women came up there, they came up with their husbands, their husbands would introduce them, and then their husband would explain how the wife decided she wanted to come. The husband did all of the talking for that woman. And very, very often, when I got to talk to the woman herself, she was very, very timid and very afraid to talk to a stranger. You don't see that today. That's another thing that was quite common. And after I would usually put my arm around the woman if he was going to the mass meeting and I would want to take her and introduce her to other women, I'd put my arm around her shoulder, ask about her children first, because she was very concerned about that. And once she felt that you were interested in her and she could tell you a little bit about who she was in terms of her children, then she felt a little more comfortable. And when she got with other working class women who came from a very limited experience, they could talk. But they had difficulty.
Really very different from them.
Yeah, it's too bad, but that's the way it was. They viewed me as a very, very smart woman and living a different kind of life. But
why did they view their life as different?
Let's see. In the first place, I didn't live in a shack. I rented an apartment from my father's apartment building in the center of town. I was a local person. I had been born and raised there in the vicinity. And I had graduated. I had gone to high school. I didn't complete, but I had gone to high. I had a high school education, in other words. And because I knew all of the union leaders by first name and I spoke to them on a very common, so that put me in the leadership class, you know. Here they're meeting people that they've read about in the papers. And I was read about in the paper later, but even when they started coming down before I was read about, I was associated with the top leadership, and therefore I must be a leader.
It wasn't just that you were part of the leadership, it was also, they saw a definite class difference. And they did not view you as a working class woman, even though you were married to someone who was in the auto shop and you were involved in the struggle.
I never stopped to think about that. I know that the one thing that used to bother me a little bit, and I worked at it, was that they, at that time, they viewed their union leaders with awe and admiration and almost worship. And there were some women who put me up there in that category, some of the very loyal women in the organization. And anything that I said, I could have said, stand on your head, you know. And I was viewed with awe and admiration, and this I didn't want. I wanted everything to be translated in their terms, and them to feel free with me, and me to feel free with them. And I did feel free with them, but I had to try to overcome the other a little. And then too, you know, the men viewed me with awe. Some of the men. Because I was a very, and they would tell their wives such things. She's a very unusual woman, and she's a very great speaker and things like that. And I think I was fairly good because I was inspired. I was highly inspired at the time. And I could move people. But I don't know. Maybe it was that I did come from, an upper middle class. How did they know that, though? I guess maybe the papers knew. I don't know. I never even thought about that.
Was your language must have been terribly different from theirs, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, that would be. Oh, yes. Although I consciously did use all of the wobbly language and labor terms, and I cussed along with not like the men, but I would say the damn flat feet and... there was a certain amount of mine was worker vocabulary from being among workers, but yes, the grammar would have been different. It would have even been my pronunciation, and I would have spoken like a northerner, you know, where that many of them came up with their dialects, southern dialects. And boy, you're making me think now.
What I'd like to start on now, then, is the planning for the takeover of Bohr. First of all, the feeling and the time for the injunction approach, that is February 1st, started to approach. then the Chevrolet back to work movement began. At what point did the planning begin for the takeover of 4 and the use of 9 as a decoy? And what role did Kermit have in the pre-planning, in your role in that pre-planning for all of that?
Okay. Now, when the back to work movement was initiated, it did hurt. There's no question about it. And many of the women, of course, of the Fisher 1 and Fisher 2 workers were saying, look, their families are going to have a paycheck, and here we are still in this terrible situation.
Why do you think they picked that time to initiate the back to work movement?
To break the morale of the union people. And they were having their big Flint Alliance workers meetings, you know, saying we're the loyal workers of GM, and big demonstrations and much more coverage in the press. They did that to break the morale of the other Flint workers, and also got out that in the other cities where we were trying to maintain some unity of action and get the tempo of activity increased with each day, that they were able to, you know, successfully call them back to work, and they did go back to work. And, of course, we were in no position to stop that, to try to put pickets across the Chevrolet division. It was much more complex and much larger, separate, 10 separate plants, no position to stop it, and we would only have demonstrated our weakness, and it would have been much worse, so they called them back to work. In fact, we thought perhaps it might relieve a little of the pressure, economic pressure, too, if they were feeling, because we knew that the loyal Chevrolet workers would go in and spend their 8 hours, and they would try to spend a couple of hours and, you know, on the picket line and help us if they could. So after the back-to-work movement, then I think is when the Chevrolet men who had been so active in this whole situation, Kermit for one, and Ed Kronk and Dal Keeler and Jess Moss and all these people who were down in the hall constantly every day, the secondary leadership of the top leadership, down there, all being sent from Chevrolet, because Chevrolet was a hellhole to work in. Conditions there were even worse than Fisher, and certainly worse than Buick. So they hated being called back to work. They resented it deeply, and that's when they began to talk more and more frequently. We've got to pull that damn place, you know. And
was Colonel Johnson also with each other?
Plant 4. Mm-hmm. And so I can't tell you exactly when, but Kermit came home, and I remember it was in the third floor apartment, that little tiny place. He came home with a piece of paper, ragged, dirty little sheet of paper, and he had it all diagrammed out how the plants could come into the exits and the entrances of this plant. Now, nowhere has that guy been given credit for devising this plan, but the fact of the matter is, of all those who have taken credit, not one of them worked in the plant. Not one of them had any direct contact so that they would know exactly what transpired in the plant. And he was the only guy of that whole top strike committee that was working in the plant. And he made a tour of that plant and talked with several other people in the plant at the time, and knew exactly which would be the quickest entrance for people coming in from the various plants, and then immediately how much time could be allotted for sealing up these huge, great, big doors. A plant, you know, would be like a huge, great, big, several-story building without the stories, and to seal these huge, great, big doors would take a tremendous amount of time. You had to wheel a great, big gondolas filled with steel in front of them, and others you had to weld them shut, and so that they couldn't be, you know, shoved open. The sliding door, so they couldn't be slid open. And so he came in with this diagram, and he took it down to the strike committee.
Which one did
he discuss it? Yeah, he showed it to me. He said, look, I got a plan. I said, take it down there and tell them. So he took it down into the strike committee, and they discussed it, pro and con, and I think it was at this juncture someplace, and this is one of the most important things that has never been written up, and I still don't have the key guide on that. I tried to get the papers on it. But anyway, when they took it into the strike committee, it seemed like such a drastic thing to do at that moment. They could not afford to have a defeat there. It was impossible to have a defeat. And they were talking on the top level in Detroit with Homer Martin and Knutson and some of the others about a settlement. Not out and out recognition of the union, but by some kind of a settlement, an agreement, an ability to work out and have some kind of discussion on their problems representing the workers. At this point, they thought maybe without pulling plant forces, if they could successfully get some kind of settlement of this strike and then build up their reserves and their forces for a future time to have UAW as a sole collective bargaining agent of the workers. This plan came just about at that time. And on the strike committee, they at first thought, no, we can't do it. This is not the time to do it. And the strike committee, I can't tell you all the names, but it would be the organizers that were from the outside. Dale, what was Dale's name? All right, there would Roy Ruther, Travis, and Krauss came in on the strike committee. And Victor Ruther, when he was in town, would sit in on the committee. He was not there regularly, steadily. And Kermit and All right, I can't remember them right now. I'd have to go back to sign.
Did it seem like it was meaning the top-level leadership of UAW?
Oh, it was. It was the whole Flint 156. That was the top strike committee. That was the strike strategy committee. This is where he took it. And at the time, they had reached this agreement, soft pedal everything across the country in Detroit. And they began to show, instead of calling the mass meetings and assigning people and so on, they just kept the token picket lines around the two plants that were struck. And they began to show movies and put on plays and things like that. But primarily, movies were shown. And people would, as workers would come up, what the hell is this? You know, where's our speakers? Where are our instructions and so on? Well, we're just holding off for a few days. Everything is quiet. And one of the movies was Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times. How do you like that? I can't remember the other one. That's right. It was a holding operation, keep everything quiet because of the negotiations going on down in Detroit. So this is when the plan, to take Plant 4, and then there was discussions, and Kermit said, but it can't be gotten out that we're going to strike this, and there's so many stool pigeons. When it's announced, when it's announced, even to small groups that's going to execute it, there will be a stool pigeon in there. So this was when also the tactic, and Travis says that this was Kermit's idea. I wasn't sure about that, but Travis said that at the University of Detroit when I spoke with him down there, that Kermit made this contribution of taking Plant 9 as the roost plant. And I know Kermit was very enthusiastic about this whole operation, and this could be worked this way. Now, the main opponent to that whole thing of taking that plant, striking that plant, was, who do you think? Walter Ruther. Now, before it was taken up at the same time or just before it was taken up in the main strike strategy committee, I think it must have been simultaneously, we were having, still the Socialist Party was meeting and consulting on all of these things. And we were having our meetings, and in the Socialist Party, we voted to consider this action. And Walter Ruther and Victor and several of the people came in from Detroit that were very concerned about it, and they sent the state organizer, John Monarchin, and it was voted down in the Socialist Party.
What was being discussed in the Socialist Party was, should four be taken?
Yeah, this
one. Should the holding action be taken, or should we move on?
Right, right. Now, this is all at this period, and when it was voted down, I was stunned. And we did have distinct divisions then in the Socialist Party grouping in Flint. And Kermit's plan was thought very feasible and absolutely the right thing to do by probably one half. It was a very slim margin that they defeated us. And so the Chevrolet workers naturally voted for it, and they were so dispirited and so disheartened. And I said, and I remember Walter Reuther coming up and saying, well, you know, you've never been in any labor, telling me too, particularly me, you've never been in a labor situation, in a strike situation. Why, you're not even dry behind the ears. This is your first experience. And don't you know it took the AFL 50 years before it was recognized? And you got to learn how to creep before you can walk and all of these things, because he was considered the leader of Detroit, Walter Reuther. Now, Roy, who was in Flint, was on our side, but he was rather quiet. He didn't want to have a split between him and his brother. Rather quiet, but he just couldn't understand why they couldn't see the feasibility of it. So we came home, and as usual, I thought, what the heck do you do? I was so convinced it was right. And I sat down and I wrote a 2-page, single-spaced, typewritten letter to Norman Thomas. I didn't know anybody else to appeal to, because the state, you know, state representative had been in there. And there was no state appeal. So I sent it to Norman Thomas. And Norman Thomas got the letter, but Norman Thomas was never an organizer, organizational man. He was a writer, a lecturer, and a thinker. And so he sent it to Chicago, to the National Labor Secretary, a man by the name of Frank Traeger. He's now teaching at New York University. And Frank Traeger came into Flint on the basis of this letter. I guess he first contacted the people in Detroit, and then he got this letter, and came into Flint. And he first conferred with the forces around Walter Reuther that were against pulling the plan, and then with us, and we took him up to the Penn Gully building. We let him talk to the workers. He interviewed them, and they were grumbling and growling and having one hell of a fit.
The Chevrolet workers?
No, all of the workers of Flint were growling because they weren't being given any directions, no fiery agitational speeches, and so on, while these negotiations in Detroit were going on. And so then Frank Traeger made the decision that he thought our group was right, our faction was right, and that he thought that the Socialist Party elements should press for this. It was put through again. Walter Reuther was bound by that.
Okay, he felt sufficiently bound by the Socialist Party.
Yes, he did, because at that time there were so many people who thought that he was a member of the Communist Party. If not a member, he was cooperating with them much more. And the Communist Party was all against our polling list, too, you know.
But it sounds I guess partially because the Socialist Party was very strong at Chevrolet 4, was that the Socialist Party really played an enormous role in the decision-making process around that.
Yeah.
Now, was the Communist Party just not involved in those preliminary discussions?
Not at the Socialist Party level. I don't know what they were doing over in their own group. They were caucusing constantly, too, you know. And they had much more outside help sent in to help them than we did. Organizers for the Communist Party during that time. So money was being dispersed from the Communist Party. I don't know what they were doing, but I know that their position was against pulling. They're relying on the negotiations going on in Detroit. And so Traeger made the decision. And when Reuther was bound by that, Walter, I'm talking about, because he was the outspoken opponent of it, he turned to Kermit and he said, all right, it's on your head. If this fails, it's going to be on your head, and don't you forget it. And that's something that Kermit never forgot, and I never forgot either, because immediately after the victory, who took the credit for it all, you know? So that decision was made by Frank Traeger. And the strike committee, of course, with the socialists up here in the top strike committee, it was passed there, and it was executed, and it has been called probably the most brilliant labor strategy of the 20th century, the whole plan. And Kermit, of course, was the strike chairman of the Chevrolet division, and afterward he was elected I don't know when the elections came up. Anyway, he was the chairman of the Chevrolet division of Local 156.
Now, were you the only one privy to using Melanie as a decoy, or did the other women in the brigade?
No, nobody knew. Nobody knew, not even the men in Plant 9 knew what the whole total strategy was, and they went at it thinking that this was the only bearing-producing plant in the country, and that they were going to pull the historic thing that was going to, you know, shut down 9 and probably the rest of Chevrolet. No, not even they knew the whole plan.
Now, but did you plan your strategy of the use of the brigade directly then with Kermit and the others around how the brigade would be used at 9 and then at 4?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Now, what was your, what was the plan that you worked out in terms of the brigade?
We were not even to call an emergency number of brigadiers at the Union Hall. All we did by word of mouth was saying, we think that more women should be turning out and up at the headquarters, and we can't have a lull in the activities, as you know, could set in with the policy that they were following, and we've got to have more women. Please get more women starting tomorrow, and starting tomorrow and the next day. And we just built it up by word of mouth. We did not send out any notices for any special action whatsoever, so that. When we went out to Plant 9, this was just announced then to the women. Everybody in the hall were going out to Plant 9, and we hear that there may be trouble. The plant police, there's been some rumors. And, of course, very often, you know, we were sent out on places on the basis of rumors, because those rumors very often materialize, sometimes yes, sometimes no. And we said, all right, there's rumors. We've got to go out there. We just got to be prepared in case. I knew, no, I knew what was happening, but it was such a critical period in the whole national strike. You know, if we could have struck Chevrolet, we knew that was the heart of the GM empire. Such a critical thing that we couldn't tell anybody then. The lieutenants, nobody knew. So we were out there when the thing happened in Plant 9, and we broke the windows, and we did everything that we were supposed to, and then... I dismissed them to make it seem like, you know, everybody was being very disheartened. We lost. The guys were being carried out by ambulance from the back and sent them back to the brigade. To the headquarters.
How long did the fighting outside of 9 last, and how long were the women involved there?
Oh, let's see. I can't tell you. The only thing that I know is there was a lot of fainting. The police were called when we showed up, and... some of the men that were at the hall showed up, and the sound car was on the other side of the street. And then the police marched down the middle of us, and there was I don't know how much time elapsed. I can't tell you. It seemed long. I was very tense because I knew what was happening, you see, down at Plant 4. In my mind, I couldn't tell you the time. And so we carried the whole action through.
Just
breaking out the windows. Yes, and that marvelous newsreel picture that was taken when the cops were threatening the Union men in their sound truck, and they were facing them, and they looked very threatening, like they might, you know, hands on their hips, as though they might be provoking another riot or something. These were city police. And the women were in back, and they had been marching around like this, I told you, with the long clubs under their long coats. And at one point, when the men became threatening, we just pulled the clubs out, and we had them up like that, and we were facing the cops. And there was a newsreel picture taken. Now, the one that's in the British BBC TV documentary shows us in this position before we had gotten the clubs raised. And he said, yes, he saw the other one, but it was very expensive, the other picture. So we had a certain amount of maneuvering and fainting and, you know, there. And we were going up and down until this action started with the police and so on. And then, right after that, the action started inside the plant. And we saw the head of Tom Clancy through the broken window. He broke the window or raised the window or something. And we saw the blood streaking down, and that was, we need air, and bam, that was our signal. And so we knew they were fighting inside, and we were just breaking windows and doing what we could on the outside. There was no possibility of getting into one of those plants.
Was it direct scuffling and hand-to-hand fighting with the police at that point on the outside?
No.
The women?
No. Mm-hmm. Even though we'd broken out the windows, the women were here. The men rushed right straight through the police, and there wasn't. I think that the police were at that point trying to, what were they trying to do? They were trying don't ask me.
How many women from the brigade were there at that point, did you say to me?
Maybe about 50, mm-hmm. 40, 50.
But there was no attempt to raise arms to keep the police from going in.
The police didn't go in.
Mm-hmm.
They had their company police inside doing all the beating.
Mm-hmm.
And their spies, all of their whole resources, all their plant police were brought from the whole big multiple complex of Chevrolet over to that one. That's what that ruse was for, was to pull all of their forces over there,
mm-hmm.
and leave the rest of it free so that plant could have been barricaded. Otherwise, the plant police would have prevented the other areas from being barricaded. So when the action was over, we sent the brigade back to headquarters. Asked them to